Yes. Unpaid flex time while he's investigating me for embezzlement. She frowns. Is the race still on? Of course it is, I snap at her. I spent the last 3 months organizing it. Do you think I'm just going to cancel it on one day's notice? Yes, but you're coming tomorrow, aren't you? It occurs to me suddenly that with everything going on, people might not show up for the 5K. In terms of the charity, it doesn't matter. I already have the donations. But I've got a local news crew coming, and it will look horrible if I'm the only one who shows up. You're going to be there, right? Kim chews on her thumbnail. I'm just not sure it's a good idea right now, with everything going on. I close my fingers around her arm. Kim, you've got to come. I need people to show up to this. You can't leave me hanging. Nat, she squirms, you're hurting my arm. I release my grip, my cheeks burning. Please, you need to come. I don't mention those pictures from her bachelorette party. She knows I've got them. She finally nods. Okay, I'll be there. You can count on me. My shoulders relax slightly. Kim will be there, and also Caleb will show up. So that's at least three of us. And I'm sure at least a handful of other people from the office will come. Greg Lowski will surely make an appearance, even if he can't finish the race. And maybe they'll find Don's killer by then, Kim says. I don't know a lot of things for sure, but I know they're not going to find Don's killer by tomorrow morning. Chapter 41. Ordinarily, I would love having an unexpected day off. I might go for a run, or go to my favorite massage place in Quincy, or maybe get a manicure. Something about getting a manicure always lifts my spirits. I don't feel much in the mood for a manicure right now. Detective Santora would probably use it against me. She's able to afford a manicure. She's obviously embezzling money. God, haven't they ever heard of Groupon? So instead, after taking care of a few quick errands, I spend the entire day on my couch, listlessly flipping between the channels. I mostly end up watching reruns of old sitcoms I've already seen a dozen times before. I'm just killing time before Caleb comes by after work. He'll make me feel better. In the late afternoon, my phone rings. My first thought is that it's Caleb, maybe on his way over early. But then when I look down, Mom is flashing on the screen. Great. But I don't have anything better to do. So I snatch up the phone. Hello? Natalie? Again, she's shouting into the phone at the top of her lungs. I only hope she's not in public. I heard they found that girl from your company. That she's dead. Yeah, I mutter. I know. Do you know what the newspapers are saying? She says. I'm not sure I want to know, but she's definitely going to tell me. They're saying people at your company bullied her. Did you bully her, Natalie? No. My God, Mom. You should be kind to people who aren't as popular as you are, Natalie. Even though I'm 30, my mother still loves to lecture me. Even though she's not as pretty as you or as well-liked, you could still be nice to her. I was nice to her. Obviously not. What is the world coming to when even my own mother thinks I'm a big old bully? I wouldn't bully someone, Mom. Well, obviously you would. She sniffs. You have. Remember how you and that friend of yours, Tara, used to, you know. What does it take to get your mother to realize that you're not a high school cheerleader anymore? I was nice to Dawn. I swear it. I know you, Natalie. I know what you can be like. Don't you remember when? As my mother drones on, I hear a beep in my ear. I pull the phone away. Caleb is calling. Thank God. Mom, I have to go. Why? Where do you have to go? I've got another call. Something for work. I'm not about to tell her about Caleb. Not now, when everything seems so tenuous. She grumbles a bit, but I'm not listening. I end the call and switch over to Caleb. He hasn't called a moment too soon. Tell me you're on your way over here, I say. Natalie, we have to talk. Oh, no. Again? This is not leading anywhere good. What? Why? Look. He heaves a long sigh. That detective came to see me again. I can see where this is leading, and I don't like it. Caleb. He kept pushing me. He sounds anguished. He kept asking me if I was sure I was with you the whole night. He kept talking about the penalty for lying to a police officer. That guy is scary. Please tell me you didn't. I had to tell him the truth, Nat. His voice cracks. I told him I left at 9:30. I'm so sorry. I wanted to reach through the phone and strangle him with my bare hands. How could you do that to me? Do you know how this is going to look? I'm sorry. I really am. But what was I supposed to do? Lie to a cop? You already did it once. It's not like he was going to find out. He could have found out. He was just short of shouting. I live in an apartment building. I've got a bunch of neighbors on my own floor. I saw somebody in the elevator on my way up. He could have easily found out I was lying. He never would have found out. You don't know that. I could have gotten in a lot of trouble. Honestly, you shouldn't have asked me to do it in the first place. It wasn't right. I'm squeezing the phone so tightly, I'm shocked that it doesn't crack in my hand. You could have at least given me a heads up. That detective already has it in for me. If you had told me, I could have told him first, at least, instead of looking like a liar. He's quiet for a moment on the other line. You're right. I'm sorry. I promise you, I wasn't planning to tell him. He got it out of me. As furious as I am with Caleb right now, I believe him. I know how persuasive and frightening Santoro can be. I can imagine Caleb cracking under the pressure, especially since he didn't feel great about lying in the first place. He's right. I never should have asked him. But in my defense, I thought he was utterly infatuated with me. Now I'm not so sure. And I had no idea how weak he is. I'm so sorry, he says for what seems like the millionth useless time. I mean, this hurts me too. I don't have an alibi either now. Right, but so what? Santoro doesn't think he's the killer. The honor has been bestowed onto me and me alone. Do you still want me to come over? He asks in a small voice. Please don't. I'd rather be alone. I don't actually want to be alone, but I don't even want to look at Caleb right now. My chest aches, and it hits me that the person I want to see most in the world right now is Seth. But then I remember, he hates me. It's amazing how quickly I've become isolated from my entire social network. My boyfriend has betrayed me. My former lover thinks I'm a thief. And even my best friend was looking at me funny. I'll come to the 5K tomorrow, he says, a peace offering. I've got my t-shirt all laid out on my dresser. Fine. I'm sorry, Nat. Every time he says it, it's a knife in my heart. But I'm sure this will all blow over. I mean, you didn't do anything wrong. How could you have? That detective is just giving you a hard time. Yeah. Except there's something more going on. I haven't told Caleb about that ceramic turtle I found in my laundry hamper. And after he snitched on me to the detective, there's no way I would consider it. But there's a reason Santoro keeps hounding me. I don't know what it is, but somebody has it in for me. I just don't know who or why. The doorbell rings and I almost jump out of my skin. Even from the sofa, I can see the red and blue lights flashing behind the front door. Oh, no. Caleb, I gasp. I've got to go. Are you sure you're all right? I'm fine. I have to go. Before he can answer, I end the call. I rise from the sofa facing the lights of the police vehicle. Except, it's not just the one light on top of the detective's car. It's more than that. There are a bunch of police cars outside my house. Something terrible is about to happen. Chapter 42. I stand at the door for several minutes, shaking too hard to work the lock and get it open. Part of me wants to make a run for it. I could go out the back door and then... Well, what could I do? My car is parked in front of the house. There's nowhere to go, and I'm hardly the type to be on the run from the police. Finally, I turn the locks and crack open the front door. It's no surprise that Detective Santoro is standing in front of my door. It's hard to remember a time when I used to be able to open the door, and he wasn't standing there.
Hello, Miss Farrell.
He doesn't even crack a grim smile. His lips are a straight line.
We have a warrant to search your house.
I don't doubt that the warrant was obtained after my stupid boyfriend informed him that I did not, in fact, have an alibi. I see. I feel like I'm choking. I guess then, come in. I step aside to allow the detective and his crew into my house. This seems like the deepest violation. These police officers are in my home, but what can I do? They obviously had enough evidence to get a warrant to search the place. I don't know how, though. I mean, half of Boston probably doesn't have an alibi for last Monday night. Should I wait in my car? I ask in a tiny voice.
We gotta search your car, too, he says, without a hint of apology in his voice. I need you to open the locks on the door.
I don't have much choice but to cooperate. I grab my car keys, direct them in the direction of my car, and I hit the key fob to unlock the doors. The lights flash as the doors unlock. Where am I supposed to go? I ask Santoro. He looks at me thoughtfully.
You can sit on your couch in the living room. I'll stay with you.
Can I stay with a friend? I could call Kim and crash at her place, if she'd let me.
I'm afraid not. I needed to stay on the premises.
We head back into my living room, Santoro leading the way, and I follow wordlessly. I searched the house pretty thoroughly last night, but not as thoroughly as these officers seem to be looking. I can hear loud noises coming from upstairs in the kitchen, the sound of a dish breaking. Thank God I got rid of that ceramic turtle. I even ran all the clothing in the laundry hamper through the wash. I sit gingerly on the sofa, and Santoro sits beside me. His black eyes are trained on mine. The room feels unbearably stuffy, like I can't even breathe. I wish I could go outside, but it's really cold out. Still, I'd rather be anywhere but here. How long will this take? I ask him.
Depends on what we find.
There's nothing to find.
I guess we'll see, won't we?
I squeeze my knees together. It hits me that even though I know Caleb told him the truth about Monday night, he doesn't know I know. Maybe I could play dumb and pretend I'm fessing up on my own free will. Listen, I say. I wanted to tell you that I was mistaken about Monday night. I remembered my boyfriend did go home before bedtime. I got it wrong.
Funny. He just told me the same thing.
I'm too late. I should have told the truth while I could.
You know, Santoro says, I got bullied when I was in school.
I pick at a loose thread on my skirt. Oh? Even though I'm not looking in his direction, I can feel his gaze washing over me.
It got pretty bad. Those kids made my life miserable.
Kids can be really cruel sometimes.
Kids don't know any better.
He cracks his knuckles.
But adults? They do. They ought to know better, at least. But plenty of adults out there are still bullies.
I keep my eyes down. I don't know what to say.
I'm sure you know all about that, Miss Farrell.
There's another crash from the kitchen. These people are destroying my house, but that's the least of my problems. After that ceramic turtle turned up in my laundry hamper, I don't know what those people are going to find, but there's a decent chance I could leave this house in handcuffs. This is the point when I should be calling a lawyer. For reasons I don't quite understand, I become a suspect in Don's murder. But lawyers cost money that I don't have right now. And also, I still feel like getting a lawyer will make me look guilty. I didn't do anything. I'm innocent. I don't need a lawyer to prove that.
Chapter 43. Monday. To Natalie Farrell. From Don Schiff. Subject: Important.
To Natalie. There is a matter of great importance that I need to discuss with you urgently. Please come to my cubicle at the conclusion of the workday today. Sincerely, Don Schiff.
To Natalie Farrell. From Caleb McCullough. Subject: Tonight.
Still on for dinner tonight? I'm cooking. Can't wait to see you.
To Caleb McCullough. From Natalie Farrell.
Subject, re, tonight.
I'll be there. There's one other thing I need to take care of tonight, but I don't think it'll be a problem.
To Mia Hodge, from Don Schiff. Subject, re, greetings.
Dear Mia, I'm just writing a quick email because I've got company coming over. It's the first time since I've lived here that I'm entertaining a guest. Unless you count the maintenance people I've had over, which I guess you really can't. Even my mother hasn't been here yet. Of course, you'll be here next month during your vacation. I've already set up the extra bedroom for you and George to stay in. I'm glad you got a good price on tickets. Telling Natalie was the correct thing to do. I sent her an email asking to meet at the end of the workday, and she came by my cubicle just before 5. When I mentioned there was a discrepancy in the accounts from last year, she agreed to come with me to the empty conference room. Then when we were alone, I told Natalie about the missing money from each of her sales transactions. I told her how much money it was, and when she heard the number, she sucked in a breath. Then she started quizzing me. She had about 1 million questions. She asked how far back in the records I had looked. Then she asked who I thought took the money, and I told her I wasn't sure, even though it seemed to me that she was the only person who could have taken it. Then she asked me who else I told about it. I didn't tell anyone, I told her, although that's not entirely true. I've told you, but she didn't need to know that. It's not like you work for the company. I was hoping Natalie would confess to taking the money and promise to return it before I had to turn her in. But that's not what happened. Instead, she started talking about other people who might have taken the money and framed her. Does anyone else have access? She asked me. Only Seth, I told her. But why would he steal from his own branch and make himself look bad? And why would he frame somebody he likes so much? But weirdly, Natalie didn't dismiss the possibility that Seth could have done it. In fact, the idea of it got her excited. She said we needed to get together and Nancy drew this mystery to figure out who took the money and why. That's when she suggested coming over later tonight. That part was exactly what I wanted to hear. She wasn't blowing off my accusations. She was concerned and wanted to figure it out. Together. We made plans to get together tonight. She reminded me not to tell anyone, because of course they would try to cover their tracks. Then she told me she was counting on me. I asked her when she wanted to get together, and I was disappointed when she suggested not meeting till 10. She said she already made plans with Caleb, and he'd be so devastated if she canceled. She giggled and mentioned he was completely obsessed with her, which I believe. She has him wrapped around her little finger. I'd been hoping Natalie and I might be able to have a nice dinner together at my house. Then I would have to worry about what I was going to serve. Natalie had very high-end taste in food, and it's hard to satisfy those kinds of taste while maintaining a monochromatic meal. Of course, I could have served her a meal that was more than one color, but that would have stressed me out too much. I've been cleaning ever since I got home. Not that my place is messy, but I want to make sure everything is perfect. I even dusted the surfaces and scrubbed down my basketball-sized ceramic turtle. I have fed Junior, and now all I've got to do is wait for Natalie to come. We're going to have a really nice night together. I have a bottle of red wine, and we can each have a glass while we talk about the situation at work. We'll get to know each other. I'll introduce her to Junior, and we'll figure out who took the money. Oh my gosh, the doorbell just rang. That must be her. Wish me luck. Sincerely, Don Schiff.
Chapter 44. This is my second day with practically no sleep. The police finally left my house at some ungodly hour. I didn't see them carrying out any bloody clothing or dismembered limbs, so I'm thinking they didn't find anything. Thank God, I can finally get back to my life again. This morning is the 5K. I was adamant about keeping it going, but right now I would seriously consider giving up one of my pinky fingers if I didn't have to do it. The weather has held up. It's brisk out, but there's no rain, and it's not unseasonably cold. After running for 20 minutes or so, it will feel perfect. I decide to take the weather as an omen. If the weather is nice, the race is going to go perfectly. Instead of the t-shirt and shorts I wear when I run around the neighborhood, I've got skin-tight running pants to wear for the 5K, as well as the special t-shirt I ordered. When I toss it over my head, I realize it's a little tighter than I thought. But that's fine. The t-shirt's running small is a minor problem. I've been organizing this 5K for the last 5 years now, so I've got it down to a science. I recruited some students from Boston College to help out, and I put them in charge of various tasks that need to be done, like manning the water stations, posting the signs for where to go, and making sure everybody running is registered. I went over everything they need to do in advance, but I usually call each of them the night before. I was in no position to do that last night, so I'm just going to have to hope everything goes to plan. Before I leave the house, I check out my appearance in the bathroom mirror. I pulled my blonde hair back into a high ponytail, and I have on far too much makeup for a 5K, but it's all sweatproof. I got a local news station to cover the race, so I want to be camera ready. And after the last few days, I would never consider being filmed without makeup on. When I stumbled into the bathroom this morning, I looked like the bride of Frankenstein. I certainly haven't had a chance to touch up my roots this week, but it will have to be good enough. I take an Uber to Florian Hall an hour before the start time for the race. I'm expecting the worst, but to my relief, Cleo from Boston College is already at the front of the building with a table of registration clipboards and a jug of water with a bunch of little cups. She helped me out last year, too, so she knows exactly what to do. "Hey, Natalie," Cleo waves enthusiastically. "We're all set." Cleo is all of 20 years old, and she looks so bright-eyed, it somehow makes me feel more tired. And she's not even going to be running the 5K. But I'm grateful to have her help. She has a cousin with cerebral palsy, so she's a big supporter of the cause. "Everyone came?" I ask. "Just about." She squints off into the distance. "Eli thinks he's coming down with the flu, although I think he's being a baby. But we've got enough people. All the signs are posted. We're good to go." "Thank you so much." My knees feel weak with relief. "You've done an amazing job. I'm sorry I didn't call to check in on you. I got busy yesterday." Cleo drops her voice a notch. "I heard what happened to your coworker. I'm so sorry. I hope they find the monster who did it." "So do I. She has no idea how much." Since everything has been taken care of, I wait around at the start of the race and do some stretches. While I'm stretching out my hamstrings, the phone I have strapped to my biceps starts to ring. I pull it out of the holster and look at the screen. It's a blocked number. I never got a phone call last night. I was waiting for it, especially while Santoro was at my house. I wanted him to see how somebody was harassing me. But of course they never called. Just as well, since I suspect he wouldn't have been that impressed. I hold the phone to my ear. "Hello?" No answer. Again. The other night, I started yelling into the phone when this happened. But thanks to Greg Lowski, I know exactly what to do. I use the track call app to retrieve the number of the blocked caller. I wasn't entirely convinced it would work. But then a number shows up on the screen, just like Greg promised it would. I grab a pen off the table Cleo set up and scribble down the number on one of the registration sheets. I stare down at the number I wrote down. The area code isn't local. I think it might be Rhode Island. I bring up a reverse number lookup on my phone and I type in the 10 digits. I was right. The phone number belongs to a motel just outside of Providence. What the hell? "Nat?" Caleb is behind me wearing a pair of gray shorts and the extra-large t-shirt I gave him earlier in the week. I want to be furious at him for what he did to me. But since he showed up here to support me, and it doesn't seem like I have a lot of support right now, I can't stay mad. Especially because he looks really hot in his running outfit. His muscles bulge under the t-shirt, which is a bit snug on him as well. "You made it," I say. He gives me a lopsided smile. "I couldn't let you down. Again." "Yeah. Nat." His Adam's apple bobs. He has the same purple circles under his eyes that I covered up this morning with makeup. "I'm so sorry about everything. I feel awful about it." "It's not your fault." "It's not. It wasn't right of me to ask him to lie to the police. That's not the kind of thing you ask your boyfriend of less than 2 months to do for you. That's more of a 6-month relationship request. And it's fine." "Yeah?" I nod.
The police came by last night and looked around. That's a very diplomatic way to describe the way they trashed my house. But they realized I don't have anything to do with Don's murder. Maybe now they can focus on actually finding out who really did it. I hope so. Also, I hold up my phone. I've been getting these weird calls from blocked numbers the last few days. Ever since I was in Don's house, I finally used this app to figure out the number, and it turns out the calls are coming from some motel in Rhode Island.
Really? That's weird.
I show him the address on the phone. This doesn't look familiar to you, does it?
Nope.
He squints down at the address.
Why would someone in a random motel be calling you?
I have no idea, but I look back at the phone number and address. It's got to have some connection to what's going on, and after this race is over, I'm driving out there.
Good idea, he nods in approval. I'll come with you.
I arch an eyebrow at him. You want to go all the way out to Rhode Island with me?
Sure, he grins, if you wouldn't mind letting me tag along.
I can't help but smile back at him. It would be nice having his company. And after the way Seth treated me yesterday, things are truly over for good in that relationship. There aren't going to be any other one-offs, that's for sure. I can't believe I was wasting my time with that jerk who is still freaking married when I've got a boyfriend who obviously cares about me a lot. I tug playfully at the hem of Caleb's t-shirt. And maybe tonight we can have a makeup dinner for the dinner we missed last night? His eyes light up.
You're on.
Out of the corner of my eye, I see the news crew setting up the cameras. Fantastic. The crew has arrived just on time. I have plenty of time to do a quick interview to explain the goals of the charity, and then they can catch the beginning of the race. About a dozen people have shown up to run today. I initially had nearly 50 people expected. But it looks like the Don situation has kept people home. It stings because a larger number of participants helps to spread more awareness of the charity. But we still get the money to donate either way. This is for Amelia. I can't forget that. And even though some of the runners stayed home, a considerable crowd is forming to watch the beginning of the race. As I face the crowd, I force my lips to form a smile. I'm not exactly in a smiling mood, but if I keep it on my face, maybe I'll start to feel better. I wave at the spectators, and a heavyset man wearing one of our t-shirts waves back at me. That's when I notice somebody behind the man. Somebody familiar. I recognize that stringy brown hair and horse face. Is that Seth's wife? What is she doing here?
Hi, Natalie!
Maria Monteiro from the news team waves to me, and I'm forced to rip my eyes away from the crowd. Maria covered the race last year as well, and she looks perfectly made up in a dress suit, her black hair shiny and her lipstick blood red. Do you have time for a quick interview before the race?
Absolutely, I hesitate. But I just want to say I'd rather not talk about my coworker, Dawn Schiff.
I know she's been all over the news lately, but I don't want to detract from the reason we're running today, to raise money for cerebral palsy. Maria can't hide the disappointment on her face, but to her credit, she quickly recovers.
That's fine. I completely respect that.
Thanks, Maria. I appreciate it. I glance back at the crowd, my eyes searching for Seth's wife again, but she seems to have vanished. Or more likely, it wasn't her to begin with, and I'm just being paranoid. I reach behind my head to straighten out my ponytail, and I smooth out the creases on my t-shirt, so viewers will be able to see the writing. Maria gestures to her cameraman, and he points the lens in my direction. Maria gets out her microphone, and I know from last year that she'll probably record a little intro later, and then splice the whole thing together.
So, Natalie, she says, this is your fifth year running this 5K, isn't it?
I nod and feel my ponytail swish behind my head. That's right. We'll be raising money for cerebral palsy.
And that's a charity very close to your heart, isn't it?
I nod again. One of my best friends growing up had cerebral palsy, so this race is in Amelia's honor. Maria takes back the microphone and is asking me another question. But my attention is again drawn away by something in the crowd. It's not Melinda Hoffman this time, though. I wish it were. Two of the spectators step aside to allow a large man with black eyes to come to the forefront of the crowd. It's Santoro. Maria has pushed the microphone back in my face, and I realize I have no idea what she just asked me. I say. Sorry, I... How embarrassing.
Thankfully, none of this is live. When the video gets edited, she can cut out the part where I wasn't listening to her question.
It looks like things are getting started soon, Maria observes. I'll let you get to it then, but thank you for what you've done.
Yes. Santoro is moving forward, coming closer to me. What's going on? He doesn't want to grill me again right before the 5K, does he? This is a charity event. Doesn't the man have any respect?
Caleb!
I crane my neck, searching for my boyfriend. I spot him a few yards away.
Caleb, can I talk to you?
Maybe Caleb can deal with this detective till we're done here. I've got way too much to do. The race is starting in less than 15 minutes, so I don't have time to answer the same questions over and over. They even searched my house. What more do they want from me, for God's sake? When I turn my head back to look, Santoro is right in front of me, less than a foot away. His eyes look like endless pools of darkness. Instinctively, I take a step back.
Detective, this isn't a good time.
Natalie Farrell.
His voice is flat.
You're under arrest for the murder of Dawn Scheff.
What? I feel like I can't breathe. Those darn cameras are still pointed at me. Not to mention that half the crowd has gotten out their phones and is filming me. That bastard Santoro did this on purpose. He chose the most public moment possible to arrest me. He wants to humiliate me, even though I've done nothing wrong. Maybe he's the one who planted that ceramic turtle in my laundry.
You're joking me, I sputter. How could you? I didn't do anything. What is this based on?
But Santoro isn't offering an explanation, and this is not a joke. He takes out his handcuffs, and before I know it, he's snapping them on my wrist. The cold metal bites into my skin, and my legs turn liquid beneath me. I'm vaguely aware of the fact that he's reading me my rights. Caleb has sprinted over. I catch his eye, and he looks completely horrified.
Natalie!
I hear him yell.
Caleb!
I gasp. The crowd is growing louder, and dozens of cameras are trained on me. The address I showed you. You've got to go there for me. Please.
Natalie!
Please,
I manage. Santoro jerks me by the arm. He's leading me to a police car to bring me back to the station and toss me in jail. There's nothing I can do to stop this anymore. I don't know why, but somebody has framed me, and they've done a really good job. My life, as I knew it, is officially over.
Part 2, Chapter 45, Dawn.
One of the scariest animals in the world is the soft-shell turtle. They don't look that scary. They don't even have the traditional turtle shell. They look a bit like a pancake with a head and legs sticking out. But don't be fooled. They can be deadly. They hide in the sand, not moving an inch, waiting patiently for their prey, ready to strike with their razor-sharp teeth. That's what it takes to catch your prey. Patience. We can all learn a lot from the soft-shell turtle. I've been watching the news all morning, over and over. I can't get enough of it. That moment when the detective steps out of the crowd and tells Natalie she's under arrest. The horrified look on her face as he snaps the cuffs onto her wrists. The camera crew was there to record the 5K, but they got more than they bargained for. They got the biggest story on the South Shore. I wish I still had my phone. I bet there are videos of Natalie's arrest all over YouTube, and I could watch them over and over and over until my eyes bleed. But I had to leave my phone behind at my house. There was no other choice. It had to look real. I sit up straighter on the double bed, hugging my stuffed turtle to my chest. The turtle's name is, quite simply, Turtley. What can I say? I named him when I was 4. This turtle is one of the few things I brought with me from my house. It was a risk because somebody might have noticed it missing, but it was worth the risk. I have slept with this turtle every night since I was a preschooler. I wasn't leaving it behind. It was bad enough I had to leave Junior behind. I hope she's okay. This bed is extremely uncomfortable. At home, I have a memory foam mattress with 270 thread count sheets and a down comforter. I knew the beds at a motel wouldn't be as comfortable as what I'm used to. But what bothers me most is not the low quality of the sheets or the plastic coating on the mattress that makes it hard as a rock and yet also lumpy. No. What keeps me awake at night is the fact that the sheets and the pillowcase are two completely different colors. Yes, you heard me correctly. The sheets are white, and yet the pillowcase is an off-white color that is practically tan. And even more horrifying, the blankets are blue. It makes my skin crawl just to look at it. But it's not like I can ever go home again. I miss my house. I miss my bed with the white sheets, white pillowcase, and white blanket. But again, it's worth it. It's worth anything. Anyway, this bed is surely better than wherever Natalie sleeps tonight. Jail cells aren't known to be particularly cozy. It worked out so perfectly that she got arrested on a Saturday. She's going to be stuck in a cell all weekend. I pick up the pad of paper I left lying by the bed. I handwrote a letter on it to Mia, since email is not an option right now. There were some things I still had to say, and I wanted to get them down on paper. For practical reasons, this will be the last letter I write to her. I reach for the remote control and flip around to find another news station. I want to see her get arrested again. When I get my hands on a computer again, I'm going to make that shot my wallpaper. My stomach growls. All I've got to eat is the small amount of food I've been stashing in the mini fridge in the room, although they do have some vending machines outside. My door leads right outside, and I don't have to pass any other people to get to the machines. My breakfast was a bag of Doritos. I'm not looking forward to having cheese doodles for lunch. I'm trying not to venture too far out of the motel. I do have a nondescript brown wig that I use to conceal my hair. Some people cut off their hair when they don't want to be found, but mine is already slashed off half an inch from my skull, so my only choice is a wig. A cheap wig that itches intensely if I have it on more than 5 minutes. I wear a baseball cap on top of it, so it looks more realistic. Still, my face has been all over the news lately, especially today, since Natalie was arrested this morning. It's too dangerous to walk around, even in disguise. That's a risk that isn't worth taking. I can't let myself be found. It was hard enough to get Natalie arrested. I can't blow it all when I'm so close. She needs to pay. If I don't do it, nobody else will. The news switches to a segment about me, about the life of Don Schiff. Not that they really know anything about me, but they know the basics. Where I grew up, where I went to high school and college, that I'm not married and have no children. There are a few unflattering old photographs of me, undoubtedly provided by my mother. The main photograph they always show on the news is the one from my ID photo at work. I never photographed well, but that one is particularly awful. My hair is plastered to my skull because I had recently showered, and my eyes are wide open like I've just seen a ghost. It looks like a bad mugshot. I wonder what Natalie will look like in her mugshot. Even she can't pull off a good mugshot photo, even though she's beautiful. She's always been beautiful. Maybe if she weren't, she'd be a better person. Now the television is showing my mother. I can't believe my mother agreed to go on camera and admit she and I are related. She's tearfully talking about how she wants justice for my murder. I stare at my mother's face on the television screen, waiting to feel something. Guilt or remorse. No, nothing. My mother has never been supportive of me for one day in my life. When I was a kid, all she wanted was for me to stop embarrassing her. And as an adult, all she cared about was that I sent her those checks every month. If I never come back, she might feel a little bit sad occasionally. But she'll be happy to get the money I left in my bank account. She doesn't care about me any more than I care about her. And if she knew what I was up to, she would turn me in herself. I push myself up in bed and my left wrist throbs. I've kept it bandaged since Monday when I made the cut that created all that blood on the floor of my living room. I had to be very careful about it. If I cut too deep, that would have been the end of me. I sit up straighter at a loud noise coming from outside my room. I'm on the second floor, but the walls are paper thin, and the windows may as well be made of saran wrap. There's no heat either, and I spent all of last night shivering under that flimsy, blue polyester blanket. Nobody said revenge was easy. I shut off the television and walked to the window. A green Ford is pulling into a spot just outside the main office. I push my glasses up the bridge of my nose and peer through the glass. The driver's side door to the Ford opens up. Someone gets out of the car. I recognize him immediately. It's Caleb McCullough. I tug on the shades to partially conceal my face as I watch him. He goes straight to the main lobby and disappears inside. I stand at the window, wondering what's going on in there. What is he doing in there? My stomach churns. I've been so careful. About 10 minutes later, Caleb exits the lobby. He takes a left and moves in the direction of my room. He pauses in front of the stairs that lead up to the second floor. Then he starts to climb. I take a step away from the window. What's going on? What is Caleb doing out there? And then he disappears from my line of sight. He must be on the second floor. I can hear his footsteps on the walkway growing louder, and then 3 loud knocks on the door to my room. He's here. Chapter 46. I don't answer immediately. I back away from the door, wiping my hands on my blue jeans. I glance around the room anxiously. He knocks again. Dawn! His voice travels through the thin door like he's in the same room as me. Come on, Dawn, open up. I walk over to the door. I flip open the deadbolt, and then I turn the lock. Caleb is standing there, his brown hair tousled by the wind, even though he never ended up going on that 5K run, and he's holding a white paper bag I hadn't noticed him carrying. He thrust it in my direction. I brought this for you, he says. I step aside as he enters the motel room. I shut the door behind him, lock it, and throw the bolt again. Did you see her get arrested? I ask him. He grins at me. Yeah, I was right there. I wish you'd seen her face, Dawn. It was epic. I've been watching it on the news all morning. I glance at the television screen, which is now dark. I wish I had it on repeat. Caleb digs around in his pants pocket and pulls out his phone. It's all over the internet. Let's eat, and then you can go nuts. I want to watch it now, but I'm too hungry to argue. I rip open the paper bag and pull out a turkey sandwich with mayonnaise on white bread. Caleb knows I like monochromatic meals. He even made sure the bag was white. He knows me so well. The color of food is more important than people think. Green sea turtles get their color from what they eat. They are primarily herbivores and consume mostly seagrass and algae. The food gives their cartilage and fat a green color. Just one sandwich? I ask. You don't want anything? I grabbed a burger on the way over. He shrugs. He doesn't care about things like food color. He's not like me. He's normal. Well, as normal as any guy plotting to frame his girlfriend for murder can be. Go ahead, eat. You must be starving. I tuck into the sandwich, nearly ripping it apart in my eagerness. I haven't been eating very well this week. I brought some food with me and I've been stashing it in the mini fridge in the room. But as I said, I'm afraid to go out much. Caleb only dared to come here once this week to bring me food, so I've been eating a lot of vending machine meals. My nutritional status is suffering. Caleb hesitates at the foot of the bed, looking around the room with his forehead scrunched up. This place looks different. I reorganized. He does not ask me why, although I would be happy to explain that the furniture in this motel was arranged completely incorrectly. I moved the dresser, the mini-fridge, and the lamp to be in ascending order of height. I also did quite a bit of cleaning, as it's clear the janitorial staff of the motel has been quite reticent in their duties. If he were to enter the bathroom, he might appreciate the way I reorganize all the toiletries he brought me. But he also might not. "Why were you down in the main lobby?" I ask around a mouthful of turkey and white bread. He frowns. "Did you call Natalie?" My cheeks grow warm. I didn't know he knew about that. I knew I shouldn't do it, but I wanted to hear the panic in her voice. I loved it when she was screaming at me to leave her alone. "I blocked the number before I called." "Dawn," he lets out an exasperated sigh. "That's not foolproof. She traced the call back here. She was telling me about it this morning. If she hadn't gotten arrested, she was going to be driving out here this afternoon. Do you know how screwed we would have been?" "Oh." Perhaps it was impetuous of me to call her. But then again, Caleb is not blameless. He told me about how he tormented her all week with that turtle figurine on her desk, even though it would have ruined everything if she had caught him in the act. "It's not safe to be here anymore." He runs a hand over the back of his neck. "I checked us out and settled the bill. We'll find another place today." "Okay. I'll be glad to be out of this seedy motel, although I'm sure the next place won't be any better. Really, I want to get out of New England altogether. Head south. But Caleb thinks it's too dangerous to be driving around right now. Plus, it would look suspicious if he suddenly quit his job. He's got to stick around a little longer, then we can go. I'm not sure where. I always wanted to live in the south. People are nicer down there." As I chew on my sandwich, Caleb climbs into bed beside me. I could never have done this without him. He played his role perfectly. He deserves an Academy Award. And it was so much better than I hoped. Natalie shot herself in the foot by trying to convince him to be her alibi. I don't know how he managed to pretend to be her boyfriend for that long, but he never slept with her. He swore he wouldn't. While I finish the sandwich, I turn the television back on. They're talking about the body that was found in the woods in Cohasset, brutally beaten. The body of Dawn Schiff. Or so they think. "They're going to figure out it's not you, sooner or later," Caleb remarks. "I know." "Christ," he mutters. "What are the chances, you know?" He's talking about the coincidental fact that a body turned up of a woman approximately my age, and apparently her face was so badly beaten, they assumed it was me. The news mentioned most of her teeth had been knocked out, so they could not use dental records. It facilitated Natalie's arrest, but ultimately, it won't matter. Eventually, the DNA will reveal that the dead body is somebody else. This random dead body won't send her to prison. Caleb's eyes are still on the screen. "What kind of sick person would do something like that?" "There are a lot of sick people out there," I say. "You should know that by now." "Yeah, but to be beaten so badly, they can't even recognize who she is." He turns suddenly green. "And nobody is even looking for her." I stuff the last of my turkey sandwich down my throat, and I nod in the direction of the phone in Caleb's hand. "Show me the video," I say. He's got one already ready to go, which makes me think he's been obsessively watching them the same way I have been. He hates her as much as I do. He's been waiting for this as long as I have. We're both soaking it up. In this video, you get a close-up of Natalie's face as that detective reads her her rights. You can see her lips contorting in an ugly way. Her face turns bright red, and then she's yelling something. "She's calling your name," I observe. "Yeah," he says quietly. "She is." The detective jerks on her cuffed arms and she stumbles. He leads her to the police car and shuts her inside. She's crying now, big ugly tears, and snot is bubbling under her nose, but she can't wipe it away. "Oh my God," I stare up at Caleb.
We made this happen.
We did.
We sit there for a moment, staring at each other. Caleb is the first one to lean forward and press his lips against mine. I grab two fistfuls of his shirt, pulling him even closer. He pushes me down onto the plastic-wrapped mattress with the white sheet and the tan pillowcase, climbing on top of me, careful not to touch the bandage on my wrist.
We did it,
I gasp, as his lips make their way down to my neck.
We did it.
We did it, he breathes in my ear. I love you so much, Dawn.
I love you too.
Caleb is kissing me and unbuttoning my shirt, and I don't even care anymore that the sheets are a completely different shade of white from the pillowcase. He fumbles for the remote control to turn off the television, but I grab his wrist to stop him.
I want to watch, I tell him, in the background. Okay?
Caleb gives me a look, but I've made plenty of strange requests of him over the years. This is not the strangest. Not by a long shot. The man has agreed to sleep in a bed with no less than a dozen stuffed turtles.
Yeah, it's fine.
What Caleb is doing to me feels so good, and I want it so badly, but can't help but keep one eye on the television. Natalie is on there again. She's facing the camera, a smile plastered on her lips. This must be before she got arrested.
This race is in Amelia's honor,
she's telling the reporter. Despite everything, her words fill me with white-hot rage. How could she say that? That lying bitch. How could she tell the world that Amelia was her best friend and all of this is in Amelia's honor? I look over at the table by the bed, where the pad of paper with the letter to my own best friend is written in my neat cursive, which Mia would know instantly. I close my eyes, remembering the words I scribbled on the paper in the ballpoint pen. Dear Mia, you would have been so proud of me today. The police arrested Natalie Farrell. She was at her stupid 5K race, and right in front of dozens of cameras, they snapped handcuffs on her wrists and took her away. You should have seen the look on her face. I have dreamed of this day for so many years. Caleb and I dreamed about it together. There were times when he started to go soft on me, asking if it was worth it to go through with it. But I didn't let him give up. I wouldn't. And together, we made this happen. Now Natalie will go to prison for the rest of her life. That's what she deserves. Although she will technically be going for a crime she didn't commit. Still, since she is guilty of murder and was given a free pass, it feels justified. I told you I would get vengeance. I told you I wouldn't let Natalie get away with killing you. I made a promise on the day you died, and today I honored that promise. I love you. I will never forget you. Sincerely, Dawn Schiff.
Chapter 47.
Amelia was her given name, but her friends called her Mia. Natalie wouldn't know that because she was never Mia's friend. Natalie's view of the world is very Natalie-centric. If something isn't happening in her own personal little bubble, she doesn't know about it. That's how she managed to work in a cubicle next to mine for 9 months without realizing that the two of us went to high school together, albeit briefly. I always thought she was going to eventually figure it out, and my cover would be blown. But she never did. To be fair, I looked very different in high school. I wasn't as thin as I am now, and I had longer hair then. I was also a year ahead of her, because in sixth grade, Mia was out most of the year after a bad case of pneumonia, put her in the hospital for months, and she was held back. And Natalie transferred from another school at the beginning of her junior year. So we were only in the same school for a single year, in two different grades. Even though she was the new girl, Natalie was the queen of our high school. Any surprise there? And Mia wasn't. Her mother gave birth to her 10 weeks early, and she had lived with cerebral palsy her whole life. Her mind was fine, but she needed braces and crutches to walk. Her speech was slurred, especially when she got excited,
which embarrassed her terribly. I met Mia in first grade. We were supposed to pick buddies for a class trip, and I watched as the kids paired off, as always, leaving me to be assigned to be buddies with another loser that nobody liked. Or worse, the teacher. So I was surprised when the new girl with braces and crutches came straight over to me. "Dawn, will you be my buddy?" I was so astonished. I didn't know what to say at first. Even at age 7, I was used to being excluded from everything. Nobody ever invited me to their birthday parties, unless they invited the whole class. And even then, they often found a way to exclude me. At first, I thought Mia might be teasing me. But then I saw the earnest, wide-eyed expression on her face, and something happened to me that had never happened ever before. Another girl wanted to be my friend. Of course I said yes. Mia was the greatest friend who ever was. She made my life worth living. Before she came along, I was utterly alone. People always made fun of me, and Mia had the same experience. It was just part of life for both of us. My mother told me I deserved it for being so weird. Mia was lucky enough that her parents were more supportive, and she had a big brother who looked out for her. We hoped things would get better as adults, but we accepted that kids can be cruel. And when we were together, it didn't seem so bad, especially because we defended each other. For example, in third grade, when Jared Callahan wouldn't quit making fun of Mia, I pushed him right off the monkey bars. You can bet that stopped the teasing. And when Duncan Albright wouldn't stop calling me Turtle Girl, Mia threw some water on the crotch of his pants and started a very popular rumor that he wet himself. We had each other's backs. Always. But when I was away at college, that's when things deteriorated. I couldn't be there for my best friend. I couldn't defend her anymore. All we could do was talk on the phone while I would reassure her that she was going to be okay. But that wasn't enough. Mia had a disability, and she was never apologetic or ashamed about it, so it was painful to watch her change in that way. The other kids giggled about the way she walked on crutches. Kids would try to trip her up, make her fall. On one occasion, she took such a bad spill in the hallway that she chipped her front tooth. And then they made fun of her for her marred smile. But the worst part was the way they made fun of how she talked. I loved Mia's voice. I would give anything to hear it again. We used to talk on the phone for hours, and even though it took a little getting used to, I never had trouble understanding her. But she used to garble her words, especially when she was nervous or excited, one syllable slurring into another. Natalie came up with a particularly nasty way to make fun of Mia. They shared a math class together, and every time Mia would answer her question, Natalie and her best friend Tara Wilkes would mimic the answer in that same slurred voice, low enough that the teacher couldn't hear it, but everyone around them could. It gave other kids ideas. It started happening in all her classes. And when Mia complained about it, the teachers wouldn't do anything. Natalie and Tara would never do anything like that, they would say. After a couple of months of this torture, Mia stopped raising her hand in class. We mostly communicated on the phone because I was long distance, but it was hard not to notice the change in her personality. Mia had always been a strong person, stronger than me. She was the one who told me not to let myself cry in front of anyone else. But Natalie and the other girls broke her. I could hear the pain in her voice. "Hang in there," I told her. "High school is almost over." "I know," she said. "Believe me, I'm trying. I won't let Natalie win." I didn't know what to do. I thought about calling Mia's parents to let them know what was going on, although she would have hated that. I even went so far as to type an email to Mia's brother, hoping he might be able to do more than I could. But in the end, I believed Mia would get through it. It was, after all, more than halfway through senior year. Soon she'd be in college and would leave all of this behind. Then there was the Valentine's Day incident. For as long as I knew, Mia had a crush on a boy named George. We went to school with him since kindergarten. And she used to fantasize about marrying him someday, even though she laughed when she talked about it. George was a nice kid, as far as I could tell. He wasn't particularly handsome or popular or athletic, although he wasn't an outcast like we were. He never laughed at Mia or made fun of her. He said hi to her in the hallway. He was kind. In the days leading up to February 14, Mia received a series of notes from George. She read them to me on the phone. They were exactly the sort of sweet notes that I would have expected from George, and I was so happy for her. It felt like things were finally turning around for my best friend, even though I desperately wanted a boyfriend of my own, which seemed like an impossibility. I wasn't jealous. I only wanted Mia to be happy. It wasn't until Valentine's Day arrived that Mia approached George when she saw him carrying a red rose. She thought the rose was for her, but it was for some other girl that he had a crush on. He was never interested in Mia. Not now. Not ever. The notes were all from Natalie and Tara, playing a joke on her. George had no idea about any of it. Natalie masterminded the whole thing, and while George tried to be nice about it, he made it painfully clear he had zero romantic feelings for Mia and never would. 2 days later, Mia took her own life.